In this episode, we speak with the founder and CEO of Gelato, Henrik Møller-Hansen. Gelato represents the world's largest network of print-on-demand and logistics options. They produce personalized print products in 33 countries, reaching more than 5 billion people. Gelato's mission is to empower the rapidly growing creator economy with local production and delivery of customized items to every consumer on the planet. The company is backed by Insight Partners and other notable investors. Henrik and his team originally launched Optimal Print in 2007. As the company grew, so did the idea of how to improve the profitability and efficiency within the printing industry. This led to the launch of Gelato in August 2012. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of GrowthCap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
Henrik, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you operate in a space that is front and center in today's economy. We're talking about the creator economy and in combined with producing products. I'd like to go back to, because this company has been around for some time, tell us about when you came up with the idea and what kind of prompted you to then start the company.
Yeah, so we've been around for about 15 years. My background is actually that I worked in a telco before I founded this company. I was the CEO for about a $400 million company. And so kind of at the heart of that company was the fact that in the global telco industry, there is massive overcapacity. And the idea in this company was to leverage that overcapacity and focus on building the software instead and not owning yet another network in the same country. So after a while in this company, I was there for about 7 years. I just felt it became too big, too political, and I'm a really lousy politician. So really having no idea what to do, I resigned. And I was thinking about, like, what have I actually learned during these 6-7 years? And so I went back to this asset-light model, which we call traveling like the nomads, light and fast without owning any fixed assets. So what I literally did was since I'd resigned without knowing what to do, I bought a bunch of business magazines, and then I flew to Portugal with my family. At the time, my daughter and wife. And I started reading these business magazines, and I had a few dimensions that I searched for when I thought about what type of company to start. And the first one was, like, the demand has to be global. There has to be a significant overcapacity. Also, no really strong software player. The industry should also be giant in size, so I didn't have to, you know, focus on building the demand. So the demand should already exist. And then really also with no strong customer focus traditionally in that industry. And so what I ended up finding was a couple of articles about something as boring as printing. Mm-hmm. And then, like, everyone I spoke to was kind of saying, like, printing, you know, it's dying, and that's such a legacy burden industry. And in one sense, it's true, and in another sense, it's completely false. So it's true if you look at the old traditional offset industry, but it's not true if you look at the digital print industry. And the digital print industry is actually, you know, believe it or not, but you can check out these numbers for yourself, it's one of the fastest growing industries in the whole world. Because when I founded the company, digital printing was doing about $80 billion globally. And last year, it was about $200 billion plus. And just to bring that into comparison for the listener, the global online music industry with, you know, the usual suspects like iTunes and Spotify is about $17-18 billion. So basically, more or less, we've added half of the music industry every single year in the digital print space since I founded the company. So that's really, you know, seeing that gap. If you go back to the print industry and you think about those dimensions, it's global, massive overcapacity. When I looked into the industry, it was like 6 times more machines and more capacity than demand. No software that connected all of these assets in a good way. Giant in size, as I just mentioned. And then also, what another thing I noticed, like no one was really focusing on the customer. Most of the people in the companies I spoke to, they focused on their machines. So that's really what brought me to the decision to start this company and go into this industry.
I can imagine, I mean, this was a long time ago, and maybe the number of creators out there wasn't as significant as it is today. Was it serendipitous, or did you already foresee the creators, that population of folks running their own kind of niche businesses growing and in effect then needing to order these products and support their fan base? Was it serendipitous, or did you foresee that happening?
I think any entrepreneur, any founder that claims that they've got it all figured out the day they started is, you know, in need of a different conversation than ours. So no, I think there are so many turns and unknowns when you set out. I think it was Jeff Bezos from Amazon that said, "No, I remain firm on the vision and the strategy, but flexible in the execution." What I did know was, going back to the company I worked for, Tele2, like we were operating, that was about a $6 billion company in total across the world. I led Norway. We operated in 23 countries. And so I knew the inefficiencies with marketing collaterals and just organizing anything that had to do with the brand. So the creator economy was not at all part of the initial business plan. It just, in the beginning, it actually came without us really taking notice of it. And then we started to get these inbounds, and a company called Spotify, another company called Etsy, popped up on our radar screens. And we realized that much of what they created, the creators, the designers, the entrepreneurs, they wanted to turn that digital creation into something physical. And, you know, what really sparked that transition, because we started out as a company basically targeting families with greeting cards, posters, photo books, and so forth. But as the creator economy merged, we saw that as an opportunity. We got some inbounds. But then in March 2020, COVID hit. And all of a sudden, you know, coincidences and a lot of luck, which you need to have when you build a company. But all of a sudden, we saw a huge amount of inbound requests to connect to Gelato via Shopify, via Etsy. And we had spent some time before March 2020, of course, not knowing what challenge the world stood before, building that integration with Shopify and Etsy. So when the pandemic hit us, we basically almost that week launched our integration with Shopify. And so we, if I may say so, we actually, from a business perspective and growth perspective, really benefited from the outbreak of this pandemic, coupled with the creator economy and people, you know, going through a lot of hardship, being unemployed, searching for alternative sources of income. They gravitated towards these platforms, these e-commerce platforms. And then as soon as they wanted to have something fulfilled, for example, a wall art being produced, a t-shirt being printed, a book being produced, they needed someone to fulfill that. And then they came to Gelato. So the creator economy was absolutely not part of the first game plan. But as luck sometimes has it, we have benefited from the creator economy just growing explosively.
Mm-hmm. And are they driving the bulk of your revenue?
Today, I would absolutely say so. But then you can discuss what are the macro factors driving that. Well, obviously, you know, the creator economy is one. But then if you're an entrepreneur building an e-commerce store, you want to reach the global community. So the fact that we don't own assets and we have obsessed from day one on software has also allowed us to then connect to production hubs all across the world. In these production hubs, we are allowed to produce locally and ship locally. And that benefits a creator that wants to reach billions of consumers. So at the heart of this growth actually also counts the fact that a creator today wants to go global. Mm-hmm. The other macroeconomic factor is just the fragility of the supply chains that has been surfaced during the pandemic, of course, but then also you have the war in Ukraine. We've now had this horrible war in Middle East. And so also local production, local distribution is more and more a natural choice of manufacturing because you have seen so many challenges with the old traditional model. And then finally, I would just also say that you see some legislation within sustainability, especially in Europe, but in other markets and continents as well. But in Europe, it's very prominent. If you want to abide to and uphold to the new legislation coming our way here in Europe, there is a force pushing you to move your manufacturing local. And I believe that for many companies, Gelato's local production model will be something that they will naturally gravitate towards. In short, there are many global factors that is pushing our growth, but the customer is predominantly stemming from the creator economy. Yes.
I imagine there's like thousands of different kinds of products that are printed on or that are kind of facilitated through your platform. Are there one or two that are very popular? Is it a t-shirt? Is it a mug? Like what are the favorites of these creators?
I would actually answer that just by having you look around. Like, if you just think about yourself, your loved ones, clothing is definitely something I believe we will use for a long period of time. But then, of course, you have art around you. Wall art is hugely popular, and it's also something you change as you grow through life and as different things in your family life is happening to you. You buy different types of art, personalized photos or just pure art. So it's both clothing and wall art. What we now see, and I was very, you know, fortunate to be invited to the World Economic Forum in Davos. One of the themes that I focused on a lot was 3D printing. So if you couple a local production network that is completely global with the 3D printing or additive manufacturing methodologies that is coming our way, I'm foreseeing a future where most of the things we have around us, including the table I have my computer on or the phone case that is protecting my phone or the chairs I'm sitting on, I believe in 5 to 10 years, that will be possible to produce locally at very good quality and very competitive pricing. So the products we sell today that are most popular, I believe is more a consequence perhaps of technology than the actual demand.
That's fascinating. I'd like to go back to that point in your entrepreneurial journey where it's really interesting that you decided to leave your career without having a definitive game plan. And what was it such that you felt, I don't know, maybe this is not the right terminology, but trapped in a corporation and you knew you could do more? Like what was the kind of feeling you were going through?
I'll be a bit personal here. I was fortunate enough after graduating from Stockholm School of Economics to work very closely with two people. One, his name was Jan Stenbeck. He died, unfortunately, way too young at the age of 56. But he co-founded Vodafone. He founded Metro International, the free newspaper, Tele2, the company I worked at. Basically, five unicorns and 70 other companies. He Swedish originally, moved to the U.S., went to Harvard and then Morgan Stanley, and then came back and took over his family companies. I would say personally, and of course I'm biased here, but I would say he's one of Europe's most successful entrepreneurs. And I was fortunate enough to work very closely with him, but also another person, Lars-Johan Jarnheimer, who's today the chairman of IKEA Group. And basically, it was a couple of things that I brought with me. I mean, many things, but two things in particular to answer your question. Jan Stenbeck always said, you know, if you're going to build something, think really big from day one, because in the Nordics, it's basically the only thing that there is no tax on. So that's one thing that I felt as Tele2, the company, the telco I worked for, as it grew bigger and bigger, I felt that it lost that entrepreneurial spirit, right? And the other thing that made me take this leap was that when I joined Tele2, it was a much smaller company. It was basically doing like 600 million euros. And as I said, when I left, it did 6 billion. And with the growth came a lot of stigmatized views on how you should operate in a company. You know, risk taking went down, growth hunger went down, politics were on the rise. And so it was also a bit like you said, I felt a bit trapped. And it came to a point, back in, I think, 2006, where my wife actually pointed out on a Friday night over a glass of wine that, you know, you don't seem happy. And actually, as a matter of fact, you seem quite depressed. And I dished that off and said, no, I'm feeling just fine. And then I woke up on Saturday and I said, like, this is not a life I want to live. So it was on Monday, literally that Monday, I pinged Lars-Johan Jarnheimer and I said, you know what, this is not for me. And then he asked, like, okay, well, you can't, like, this is crazy. You can't resign from a job like this. Like, what are you thinking? And what are you going to do? And I actually said, I don't have a clue. But that it was more important for me to have kind of that liberty of building something and working in an environment that represented the kind of pace and entrepreneurial spirit that I wanted. And I remember when I called my mother and said, you know, I've resigned. And that was a relatively big job for a person at the age of 32. And she was like, are you crazy? Like, why are you doing this? And what are you going to do? Tell me. And I said, I don't have a clue. And she actually began to cry. She was so concerned for my future and my family. And then when I called back 6 months later and say, now I know what I'm going to do. And she said, well, so what are you going to do? I said, I'm going into the printing. And then she started to cry again. So it was, you know, just a personal kind of life is too short to work in an environment where I'm not happy. And I would actually add one third element, which was staggering to me, because at the time I was like 30 when I took over this company. And at the age of 32, I made a lot of money for being 32. And what was astonishing to me was how little that impacted my happiness. So I think to myself that I was lucky because I made so much money at a young age that I know 100% sure I'm not motivated by money. Not at all. That has not been part of this journey and it's never been the propeller.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the key has been to you being successful in this journey to date? I mean, there's lots of examples of people that, you know, maybe move from corporate or from another domain and try to become an entrepreneur and they're not able to kind of grow a company or grow an idea. Is there, you know, one or two key insights that you think are, you know, imperative in order to succeed as an entrepreneur?
First of all, I don't consider myself to be successful. And I think if you do, you're not aiming high enough. And perhaps that is part of the answer. So I never viewed myself as successful. I still don't view myself as successful. I had from day one an ambition to go and build a company together with an amazing team and make the world a bit of a better place. That has genuinely, might sound a bit trite, but that has genuinely been my ambition. I think there have been a few kind of key things that has impacted my life. The first one is that I spent almost 2 years in the underwater demolition team. And it is not as macho as it might sound. I would say, on the contrary, I think there are three things that you learn pretty quickly. Number one, if you need help, ask for help. Number two, if you don't know, just raise your hand and say, I don't know. And if you make a mistake, just raise your hand and say, listen, I made a mistake. I'm sorry, guys. Like, as fundamental as that sound, I have seen, and it's not that I also do this all the time, but it is actually quite hard. But I have also seen how you can lead people that are much more experienced, much older than you, by admitting weaknesses. And when you make mistakes, and asking for help is a sign of strength, it's not a sign of weakness. So I think my time in the UDT has really profoundly shaped me. The second thing is that when I worked in Tele2, you know, a person that worked with Jan Stenbeck before me was Niklas Sandström, and he left and founded Skype. So Jan had this ability to eradicate your memory from what you had learned in school and instead start to really access the big thinking and the creativity. And somehow I think there I met such great people. So when I realized this is what I want to do, I want to go into the global print industry, build a software that connects all of that overcapacity, and let any human being on the planet access this network and produce what they need, when they need it, where they need it. And when I came to that conclusion, I pinged some of the people I admire, some of the people that I love working with, and most of them work with me today. And so many people here in Gelato I worked with for 20 plus years. And there is this really good book, 5 Dysfunctions in Teams. And at the fundament of a functioning team lies trust. And if you have trust, you can actually have productive conflicts. You can get a lot of commitments. You can delegate accountability. And that all combined leads to the fifth factor, which is results. So I think the fact that I have this team is the second really, really important factor from day one. I had an amazing team. We still have this, probably the thing I'm most proud of, the type of people that today, like if you look at our leadership team, they come from Amazon, Bain, McKinsey, Schlumberger, and it's like they come from all these amazing companies, eBay also, and they leave these companies to join Gelato. And I think they do that because they want a company that makes meaning and they search for purpose. But it boils down to, I would say, what I learned in the underwater demolition team, and then also the team that I've been fortunate enough to surround myself with. And then, of course, you need to, it goes without saying, I mean, you need to have an idea. And for me, the idea was structured around a few dimensions that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. What's currently the biggest challenge that you're trying to solve in order to, I'm sure there's, you know, probably a portfolio of things you're working through, but is there one key thing that you in particular are focused on?
Life is filled with challenges as an entrepreneur, but I think the biggest thing that I'm orienting my thinking around now is to move from a transaction-oriented company to a software company with more predictable revenue streams. Like, in the nature of our business model lies transactions from creators that are connected to consumers across the whole planet. So in Q4, for example, meaning Q4, meaning October, November, December, for natural reasons with holidays and Christmas for some, we see a surge in orders. Now, as you grow a company and as you come to a certain size that brings the company from a startup to a scale-up to a more established global company, one important factor is the predictability in your revenue streams. And that is something I'm working now, you know, a lot with our investors, the amazing board that I have, and also the team here to really elevate the software aspect, both for the creators, but also for the makers, the production partners. So that's really the biggest thing in my head that I invest most of my energy thinking around and working with.
Mm-hmm. We're coming up on time. I have two final questions. I have a feeling we may have covered one of these questions earlier in the conversation. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
I mean, yeah, I think we covered that previously. Mm-hmm. I would say without Mr. Stenbeck, Gelato would not exist.
Got it. Last question. Can you tell us about a charity, cause, or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Yeah, actually, it's not only me, but it's me and my wife. Like, one of the things that we think a lot about is the next generation and education. And for us, education and educational institutions is the cradle of innovation. And I mean, if you look at Stanford alone, I think over 5 million jobs and, you know, annual revenues of closer to $3 trillion from companies that have stemmed from Stanford has sprung out of that institution. So we have actually donated quite a lot of money to the Norwegian School of Economics, which is the leading business school here in Norway. So each year, the students and the faculty gets to pick the best teacher that the students. I mean, we invest a lot in PhD and heavy academia, but we invest quite little, at least relatively little, into teaching abilities. So we every year now, we have a relatively big donation, roughly $25,000 per year to the best teacher at Norwegian School of Economics. So that's something we're very proud of.
Excellent. Well, Henrik, want to thank you so much again for taking the time. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. Good questions. Thank you.